You're listening to the Belfer Center's Office Hours. This episode...
The average person on the street will say, I see the lock, therefore it's secure. You could be giving your data away to criminalmastermind.com and you'd have that green lock.
Cybersecurity expert Bruce Schneier, author of Click Here to Kill Everybody, and a research fellow with the Belfer Center's Cybersecurity Project, talks cybersecurity, tech, and the hacker mentality. For more insightful conversations with experts from the Belfer Center and beyond, subscribe to Office Hours on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. Here's host Arup Mukherjee.
All right, you're a security technologist. You're a security guru, as The Economist has put it. And what brought you here? As a kid, were you just the most concerned about security of your school ID? Did you always know where it was?
No, I think security is not really about paranoia or being concerned. It's about hacking. It's about figuring out how to break systems. And I think that's something that is a innate special type of curiosity, that when you see a system, you think, how can I break this? Or you walk into a store and you think, how could I get away with shoplifting? You walk into a voting machine, you say, can I subvert this process? You don't actually do it.
So you must have been very
typical
to raise.
But that is the way you think. And I think I've always thought that way. I got to this place really through an endless series of generalizations. I started out in mathematical security, cryptography, secret codes. My first book was about cryptography, 1993. And since then, I've been generalizing in an attempt to understand security. So I wrote about computer security and then network security and then general security technology. And then I started writing about the economics of security and then the psychology of security and the sociology of security. Now I really write about the political science and the public policy of security, all trying to understand how this all works in context. But I really think the origins is this hacker mentality, which is not focused on how something works, but how it could fail.
So as a kid, that was something that were you just obsessed with that idea, not even just related to computers at all? Was it anything?
I mean, I'm obsessed feels like a strong word. You know, I was certainly interested in it, and it is the way I thought. So here's an example. Now, there's something called an ant farm. You might have seen them. I think you can still buy them. Uncle Milton's Ant Farm. It's two pieces of plastic with sand in the middle, and there are ants that can crawl around. You watch them make tunnels. Really cool kid toy. When you buy them, they don't come with ants because that would be weird. But there is a card that comes with the kit that you can mail into the company, and they will send you a tube of ants. So a normal kid says, neat, I can get a tube of ants in the mail. A kid like me says, neat, I can get a tube of ants mailed to anybody I want. And it's just a matter of looking at the system and seeing how you can misuse it.
Oh, that's great. So here's another question. You being a technologist, there seems to be some sort of disconnect, because as you get older, you learn more about the process, you learn more things, but you also get more distanced from the way that people communicate, or young people communicate. How do you keep up to date with modern trends of communication? Do you have to have focus groups with, you know, high schoolers? What's the method there?
Now, I read a lot, and I'm not convinced I do keep up with trends. I might be a trend behind. I try to keep up, but there are people who keep up with trends, right? This is something that is done. So I read and I pay attention and I try to watch what other people are doing. I tend not to do the things. Even I don't have a Facebook account. I don't have a Twitter account. I don't have an Instagram account. I don't have an anything account. So I'm less likely to be a doer just because I'm busy and those are horrible time sinks in addition to being toxic companies. But I try to pay attention to what others are doing. And a lot of ways, the details matter less. You know, whether it is email or Facebook or Instagram or whatever the cool kids are doing these days, most of the security level functionality is broadly the same. There's differences in business models, differences in interfaces, one's text, one's video, one's centralized, one's decentralized, but these are tropes that aren't new either.
And so we've dealt with these, we've grappled with these principles before.
We have. I mean, there's not a lot that's new. You know, the bright, shiny toy is often something that we used to do 20 years ago. It was harder. It was more cumbersome. Only techies could do it. But it's the same thing.
So you wrote a book. It's called Click Here to Kill Everybody.
It's a great title, isn't it?
Yes, you went for subtlety, it looks like.
You know, I think books have to grab attention. I mean, it's my first clickbait title.
Yeah.
And yes, it is a provocative title. I back off from it almost immediately. If you read the book in like page 4, I'm saying, you know, I really didn't mean that in the title. I just got you here to buy the book. Yeah. Now let's talk about what we're really talking about. But, you know, if that book's going to grab people's attention at airport bookstores, it's got to have a title that grabs attention. And really, I'm speaking to something that's inherently a computer security issue that's not a general issue, but will become a general issue.
Right. And so the subtitle is Security and Survival in a Hyper-Connected World. And you're talking about it's a global phenomenon you're talking about. And you call it Internet Plus. It's a phrase that a different... which encompasses so much more than what you say. There's another grouping of things called the Internet of Things. There's the Internet. There's all this other stuff. But you have this term that you call Internet Plus. Work us through what the book is about, why you felt you had to write it.
And I hated creating a new term, but there really wasn't anything that encompassed what I was talking about. What I'm writing about is a world where computers permeate everything. Now, the old world of computers is that they're specialized things we interact with via screens, our computers, laptops, and our phones is probably the easy way to think of it. We go to it, we look at a screen, and we push some buttons or move some mice or, you know, we do some input thing. That's changing. Computers are starting to permeate everything. They're in our homes, they're in our appliances, in our cars, they're in medical devices, they're power plants. And in fact, what I say in my book is that all these things are becoming computers. They are computers with peripherals attached to them, right? A car is just a computer with four wheels and an engine. And this is happening at all aspects of our life. I mean, this is the Internet of Things, all these things that will be on the Internet. And we don't interact with them through screens. We interact with them as we interact with the devices. We have an interconnected toothbrush or refrigerator. It just is on the Internet and it is interacting with our world. And that fundamentally changes the way computer security works. That's not true. It changes the threat model. Because computers used to be about data, now they're going to be about our environment. The worst thing a computer could do was delete my data. Now it can, you know, send a lethal shock into a pacemaker because it is in the physical world. So I'm writing about how this new use of computers, this new permeation of computers in our environment, changes all the old assumptions we made about computer security, all the old agreements is a bad word, the balances that we've accepted with computers and phones, how they're not going to work anymore. And Internet Plus I used because I was saying things like, I was writing the Internet plus the Internet of Things plus the large databases information plus the social media sites we communicate on plus the critical infrastructure like power plants plus. And I could either write that out every time or just write Internet plus. So that's what I settled on. And I really mean the totality of everything, because when you think about security, you have to take a holistic view as possible.
Yeah, and Internet Plus, I mean, is there an Internet Minus or Internet Neutral? Is everyone kind of living, is it avoidable?
I mean, it is in stupid terms, and you'll hear this sometimes, right? If you don't like Facebook, don't have an account. You don't like an iPhone, don't buy one. But, you know, the idea of not having an email address, not having a credit card, not having a smartphone, it's fundamentally stupid advice for living in the 21st century. So sure, you can avoid the Internet of Things. You could avoid the Internet. You could avoid anything you want. Right? And just go live in a log cabin out in the woods and don't talk to anybody. I mean, it's theoretically possible, but realistically nonsense. And as computers permeate our world, we can't avoid them. Just like you can't avoid cameras now. Right? You can't walk outside and avoid security cameras because they're everywhere. Soon, you won't be able to avoid sensors in streetlights, in sidewalk squares. When you read about the future of smart cities and the Internet of Things, they're going to be everywhere in our environment. You know, I tried to buy a car last year that didn't have internet connection, and I failed. Really? Right? They existed, but not in the class of car I wanted to buy.
Yeah.
So we're losing the ability to own a car and have it not be on the internet. Yeah. In a few years, you won't be able to buy a refrigerator that's not on the internet, or an air conditioner, or just old versions
of these things. My mom tried to buy, years ago, tried to buy a flip phone again, and was found that actually was more expensive to buy a flip phone than it was to have a smartphone.
Right, because now they're cool retro things, and only weirdos buy them. And so these are just going to permeate our environment, and we're not going to be able to opt out. Right, opting out is a very screen-based way of thinking, because you go to the screen, and you can choose not to go to the screen. If the computer is in your home, turning on and off your heat, turning on and off your air conditioning, running your appliances, you can't choose not to have appliances.
Okay, but who's doing the hacking here? Because I love the idea that my fridge can just order me some sliced ham when I run low. But who's going to be hacking into my fridge?
So there's a lot of threats to worry about, right? We have to worry about the corporations themselves, right? So when you order that ham, there's going to be some company that is not working in your best interest that will collect that data, compile it with all the rest of the data about you, and use that to manipulate you, right? That's surveillance capitalism. That's the business model of the internet. So you have to worry about the companies. These are legitimate uses. They're not illegal, right? They're hacking in a let's manipulate the system sense, but not in an illegal sense. You might have to worry about government, right? Probably not in the U.S. No one cares about your ham eating, but, you know, we can spin a scenario where there will be some, I'm going to make this up, religious police who now cares what you're eating, and they're going to collect this data for some reason. I don't know. Right. China is doing a lot of this. They're going to collect a lot of the benign data of their citizens and score them with some citizenship score, which allows them to get privileges or be denied services. In the U.S., you'd have to worry about that if you are possibly a minority or someone who does, you know, who's not a white male and doesn't have the same affordances. So corporations and government. And then you have to worry about criminals who will manipulate things for financial gain. For the refrigerator, they don't care about your ham use, but, you know, do they want to put ransomware on it? You wake up in the morning, go to your refrigerator, the power's off, or maybe the door is locked, and you have to pay some amount of Bitcoin to release it. Right, this happens against computers. We've seen it demonstrated against cars. It'll happen against appliances.
It's happened against cars.
Yeah, so. in the lab, not in real life yet, and not at speed, thankfully.
Oof.
But you know, it's coming. And lastly, we have to worry about non-nation state threat actors. You know, so what happens when someone who wants to do political damage shuts down a city, a community, and now all the refrigerators don't work, or all the cars? So the threat actors are no different than the threat actors in the computer world. These are just different vectors for them to do the things they were doing. Right? None of this is new.
It's more complex. That's one of the points of your book. There are more angles, more areas of vulnerability.
Right. It's much more complex. And remember, computers are vulnerable differently. I mean, think about cars. Everyone knows how cars fail. Cars have parts. Parts fail once in a while. And we have an entire mechanism for car failure and recovery. We have repair shops. And they have a steady stream of cars that come into them, really based on this economic model of cars and how often they fail. Computers fail differently. Computers all work perfectly until one day when none of them do. Right? That is a failure mechanism that is new for the rest of the world. And it's not something we're used to. And that's just one example of a traditional thing that's going to be different. And really what I'm writing about in my book is how it's going to be different and then how to fix it. Right? I mean, the majority of my book is solutions. And it's not tech. The solutions are policy solutions. Right? There are lots of tech problems here, but they're not actually hard. I mean, they have to be solved. Actually, say it this way. They're go to the moon hard. They're not faster than light travel hard, right? They're solvable. But to me, the real place where we have this friction, where we can't solve it, is the policy issue.
Right.
How do we get companies to design more secure devices?
Yeah.
Because right now the market doesn't reward that. And really, I'm spending most of my time in my book on public policy solutions, which is probably why I'm here on this podcast.
Now, I was going to say, well, we're at the Kennedy School. We like to think about solutions. So, well, let's work through them. So you have various people who are involved in this process. There are the people themselves who are buying the products, right? There are companies, there are governments. Do each of them have different solutions? What do people do?
Well, right now we have a market failure. That right now we're not willing to pay for security, and companies not willing to provide it. Right? An example would be Equifax. About a year and a month ago, Equifax was hacked, and pretty much every American had their personal information stolen. There were there's a lot of outrage. There were hearings. I participated in a hearing at the House. There were angry Congress people on both sides of the aisle. Something must be done. This cannot stand. A year later, absolutely nothing was done. So what is the moral if you are a company? You underspend on security. You take your chance. If you get unlucky and get hacked, you weather a couple of months of bad press and angry legislators, and then you can go about your business. This is exactly the same lesson Facebook is learning today. There's all this angry talk and nothing will happen. There will be no forced change in Facebook's business model. Right? So they have no incentive to better their security. As long as they're a monopoly, they're not going to do the work. So really, there's a strong market failure. This isn't a surprise. You go through the past 150 years of history, you won't find a single industry that improves safety or security without being forced to by government. So I see government stepping in and effectively changing the playing field. I mean, right now, the market rewards poor security, right? Getting to market quick, having lots of features, skipping on security. And we change that through a variety of mechanisms, through rigid rules. And recently in California, they passed an IoT security bill. I don't know if people know. By 2020, there will be no default passwords allowed in any IoT products sold in California. All right. This is, I can list the 20 top problems. This is one of them. Now there are only 19. So small step, not a big deal, but it is something. And it's the first thing. And we will all benefit, not just products in California, because any company that fixes their product will sell that fixed product everywhere. We need more flexible security standards. And here we're seeing the FDA, the DOT, the FTC, other organizations all starting to look at this. How do we have standards that you have to take due care and you can't have bad security, whatever that means? I mean, these are more flexible. We need liabilities, you know, ways for someone who is injured and can go to court. And I think that's starting. And traditionally, there have been no liabilities for software vulnerabilities. But as software moves into areas where traditionally there are liabilities, I think that will start changing. And here again, there are things we have to do. Right now, it's been very hard to sue companies for privacy violations. Lots of people tried to sue Equifax. But Equifax would say, how do you prove that that particular harm was a result of my actions? Your data is being stolen all the time. It could have been somebody else. And that's true. Now, we in the U.S. have a solution to that. It's called statutory damages. And there are lots of areas in our life where we can get statutory damages if the harm occurs, if the bad action occurs without having to prove direct harm. But an example is copyright. If you infringe on a copyrighted work, Disney does not have to prove that they lost money because of it. There's statutory damages that you pay. If the government eavesdrops on you against the law, you don't have to prove that you suffered harm. The eavesdropping is harm. There are statutory damages. Anyway, this is an aside, but you know, there are ways we need to fix the liability system.
So are you an optimist about this, or are you a pessimist? Do you see a bleak future? Do you see a bright future?
I'm a realist, which means I tend towards pessimism. Now, if you read the book, I have like four chapters of here are all the things that we should do. And I go into detail about the laws and the policies and things the courts should do, the agencies, the legislators, international agreements and treaties and how this works in trade. Then I have a chapter called Plan B.
That's right.
Where I basically say, all right, let's be realistic. Nothing in those four chapters will happen anytime soon. What do we really do?
Right. It's called What's Likely to Happen.
Right. And even that chapter is optimistic. My fear is that we are fundamentally not proactive as a society. We are terrible at proactive. That we are best at reactive. And that there will be some disaster, some large loss of life that will force us to be reactive, and we'll do something quick, and we'll do something ill-advised, we'll do something stupid. So really what I'm doing in this book is trying to discuss the policy issues before the disaster. Right? So we can have something in our back pocket or some ideas that after someone crashes all the cars, or I guess more likely, all the cars of one make and one model year, but still thousands of vehicles, and Congress says something must be done, we can point to say something and say, look, this is something, and it's been well thought out. It's not like the Patriot Act. It's right. It's something we've actually thought about. Because I think regulation is coming. And, you know, I give this talk in Silicon Valley, and they're very anti-regulation. But that came from a time when the internet didn't matter. And our choice is no longer between government regulation and no government regulation. Our choice is between smart government regulation and stupid government regulation. So I want to have the discussion now before it's a crisis. My worry is we will need a crisis. And it's going to be a big one. Right? I thought OPM would be the crisis. Right? Every government employee's personal information was stolen by the Chinese. I thought that would galvanize change in the law. No. I thought Equifax would be a crisis. Every American's financial information was stolen by hackers. No, that wasn't enough either.
Not even Sony.
Not even Sony, right? Not Cambridge Analytica.
Right.
I fear that the crisis that will force us into action will be a crisis that costs us life or property.
Because sort of what's called kinetic, having kinetic damage.
Right. And that's because, right, as I started out this interview by saying, we're giving computers the ability to affect the world in a direct physical manner. Cars, power plants, thermostats, medical devices, drones, weapon systems, right? They can do stuff in our environment.
The conversations we're having, the one we're having right now, did these precede the regulation involved with other forms of technology like cell phones, like TVs, cars, trains, planes? Were people worrying about the same things before regulation happened, or were we more proactive in those?
We weren't that proactive, but they happened slower. But the difference now is the adoption rate of new technologies, right? Someone can invent the telephone, and you've got 40 years to figure the laws out before they become ubiquitous. Someone invents radio or even nuclear power. You've got years, you've got decades. Now it happens too fast. You've got a year, you've got 6 months. If you think about drones is probably on the cusp. In the beginning, they were expensive and kind of weird and very specialized. And everyone said, you can't regulate this. It's too early. There's nothing here yet. And then it suddenly became, it's too late to regulate drones because they're cheap and everyone got them for Christmas last week. Mm-hmm. And there's a lobbying industry. And we have to figure out how to enact public policy on things that move fast. We're seeing the same thing with algorithms and AI and machine learning and autonomous decision making, definitions of fairness. It takes policy years to figure this out, but the tech is moving much faster. This is a more general problem than cybersecurity, right? How do we have public policy move at the speed of tech? But it is a problem. We do need to solve it.
And does either Does either party seem to be approaching this better? Does one party tend more toward, you know, the Republican mantra of deregulating? Does that extend into this realm as well? Are you seeing any changes in cyber regulation with the Trump administration?
We're not seeing a lot. You know, certainly the Democrats would be more in favor of regulation in general. But, you know, we don't have, you know, a left party in this country. We have a far right and a near right. So you really don't have anybody pushing this. The Obama administration, you know, wrote reports, really talked a good game, didn't do a lot, seeing nothing out of Trump. My guess is that you're going to see things in two places first. The states, specifically California, New York, and Massachusetts, are doing much more in this regard, and Europe. Right, the EU is the regulatory superpower on the planet right now.
They're doing it best.
They have, you know, no fear of regulating large companies and fining them fines that they actually notice, not, you know, kind of silly fines that the United States enacts. We just saw a comprehensive privacy regulation, the GDPR, and that's why you in the U.S. see a lot of new warnings when you go to websites. That's GDPR.
I got 20 emails in a span of 2 days.
And this is important. This shows you that one market can improve security and privacy everywhere on the planet. Because computers and software, it's very much right once, sell everywhere. The car you buy in the United States is not the car you buy in Mexico. Right? Environmental laws are different. The engines are tuned differently. But the software you buy in the United States is the same software you buy in Mexico and in Europe and in Asia and everywhere else, because it's easier that way. Right? California just passed that IoT security bill. Companies will rewrite their software to comply, and that improved product will be sold everywhere in the world because that's just easier. So even if, you know, U.S. government is dysfunctional and we're not going to see any of this comprehensive regulation out of the U.S., we can see it elsewhere. And a state like California or New York, a market like the EU or Japan, or even a country like Germany or the U.K. or Japan is large enough to make a difference. So that gives me a lot of hope.
Do you, when you purchase anything online and you see the little lock on the browser that says that this is secure and it's locked, do you scoff?
I don't scoff. I don't think I notice it. But here's an example again of how the market is failing. The average person on the street will say what you said. I see the lock, therefore it's secure. What does that actually mean? It means something very narrow. Doesn't mean that the website's secure. Doesn't mean that your data is secure. Doesn't mean that the transaction's going to go through and you're not going to be cheated. All it means is a transmission path between you and the website is encrypted. That's all it means. You could be going to a fake website and would still have that green lock. You could be buying an illegal product. You could be giving your data away to criminalmastermind.com and you'd have that green lock. Someone could be in your computer recording every one of your keystrokes and you still get that green lock, because that green lock doesn't mean any of those things. So here, we're trying to build something that a consumer can use, and we ended up building something that gives consumers no useful information.
Bruce, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much. It's been both extremely scary to hear about, but also very illuminating. So thank you so much for joining.
Yeah, thank you. This was fun.
Office Hours was produced by the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.